Okay. Thanks, Sabrina. So I thought that if this talk is going to have anything to do with photosynthesis, I definitely have to choose a picture of the California super bloom. This we suspect there is something quantum in there, but we've not shot it yet. Right. Okay, so I think putting together the word in quantum and biology may already raise some eyebrows, right? I suspect we don't have any biologists in the audience, right? But let's say, should there be any, they will definitely be the one that would not straightforwardly think that anything we're going to say may be of relevant in biology. Nevertheless, if you are interested, this is already a compilation of articles aiming to putting in a review form, well, the type of considerations that have been done, especially related with the process of light harvesting, so the primary steps in photosynthesis, which is the topic I'm going to discuss today. So this is the plan outlook for the talk. It's going to be a relatively self-centered talk, so you will see that most of the references are to our own work, simply because I want to tell you from the viewpoint of somebody with a background in quantum optics, open systems, and quantum information, how we looked at these systems, what we think we may contribute, and which aspects are definitely out of reach, and also to illustrate the type of methods we deployed a little bit in an onion sort of approach, trying to unveil different layers of complexity, and also illustrating where we hit the wall and definitely realize that we do need to deploy new techniques if we're gonna be able to say something. Okay? So I will first tell you what sort of systems are we talking about, and very important, what type of experiments have been performed. You may have already heard, even in the popular press, the wording long-leaf coherence. Long-leaf coherence has been observed and blah, blah, blah. So it's important that we make precise what does that mean. Long compared to what? What is short? Because the issue of timescales is going to be very relevant in this discussion. Then we put forward a bibronic model of pigment protein complexes that I would argue provides a sort of self-contained description of certain phenomena. We will then see whether this is the case or how far, what sort of conclusions we can draw. Are they in agreement with experiments? What about some other experimental results that seem to be in conflict with the ones we will discuss initially? And then going back to the theme of this program, we will discuss from the viewpoint of open quantum systems, what do we think that we need in order to move forward? Maybe I should emphasize from the beginning that this is definitely a truly multidisciplinary setting where I think to move and to progress, we definitely need the combination of very different expertise. So I believe that there are some questions that our background may be useful, but I think there are others where we'll definitely, probably will not be able to even formulate the right questions. Okay, so this may bring you maybe to high school, right, to the classes of biology. So it's quite amazing the machinery that nature has developed in order to harvest light and then to transform this energy into sugar, effectively, right? So if we look at just a leaf for a plant, in the plant cell we find and specialized organelles that they are called chloroplasts, and in the thylakoid membrane of the chloroplast is where the machinery for photosynthesis is hosted. Eh? So in cartoon-like, is here represented. So essentially, this is going to be an array that integrates harvesting antenna that will be coupled to reaction centers. So the harvesting antenna will, as its name say, harvest light from sunlight and has the task to convey it to a reaction center where the primary step of charge separation will happen. And this will be the triggering of the second step of the dark part of photosynthesis, where all the chemistry formation of ATP will happen. So once absorption of a photon occurred, then the quantum efficiency, so the probability that an absorbed photon is going to be transformed into a stable charge separated state, is very high. I mean, let's say it's documented that for in oxygen photosynthesis, so algae, plants, and cyanobacteria, goes, depending on the organism, but goes from 50% to 90%. Eh? In low light conditions, is almost 100% efficiency. Right, so I think it's useful that you have, and this is the typical illustration you will find in any textbook discussing photosynthesis. You see that hosted in the thylakoid membrane, we have this machinery which is made up of the antenna complex that has made of highly absorbing pigments like chlorophyll and has the task of delivered electronic excitations to the reaction center to produce a charge-separated state. So you already see in the cartoon how this is depicted. You see that a photon is absorbed here in this pigment and then is put a migration or a funnel pigment by pigment through the reaction center. So this is actually the dynamics that we may challenge to see whether in this cartoon presents an accurate representation of what is happening in the light harvesting process or whether we can argue otherwise. Let me show you what is the form of the harvesting antenna of purple bacteria. So this is a cartoon-like representation of the light harvesting two antenna complexes that will deliver excitations to the core complex hosting the reaction center. And these are actually real images of the complex itself, where the point I want to make, and that goes in the light of the comment I made before about the separation of time scales, is going to be different physics to be discussed if you want to account what will happen in a situation like this, where typically we will encounter different time scales concerning what would be the possible delocalization of our individual rings and then inter-ring transfer and an overall diffusion to the reaction center. So I will not discuss today this situation, right? Also because then, let's say, the type of experiments we can discuss easily concern other geometries, and because this is definitely a situation that will not be amenable to the type of combined numerics analytics we are trying to do. So I will focus the discussion today in a particularly simple antenna complexes that is a little bit like the James Cummings of quantum biology, provided by the so-called Fenner-Matthew Olson. This is the first Pickman protein complex that was amenable to full X-ray analysis, and that is present, as far as I know, only in a type of green sulfur bacteria. So it's a particularly rare complex present in an organism that lives in a very, very deprived light conditions. So this is definitely an antenna with a very high success in delivering the excitation from the chlorosome to the reaction center. And it's also, as you see, made up of 8 bacteriochlorophylls. So this is a number of pigments that could fall within what would be possible to simulate exactly. So they are called pigment protein complexes because you see that these are networks made of an array of absorbing molecules that are hosted in a protein matrix. So this is a cage where the pigments will be placed, and it's not a static structure, but I would actually see that in fact this is going to be, in our language, an environment that will play a rather relevant role in ensuring the efficiency of the whole of the whole apparatus. Okay. Right. So the
But 8 is a typical number, or is no, always it's like that?
This is present in the Fenner-Matthew also, right? And it's particularly simple type of pigment protein complex. Okay? The reason why we will use it, let's say, as our test bed is because the amount of information we have about FMO, both concerning all sort of linear spectroscopy and two-dimensional spectroscopy, together with Bing, you can just go to the protein data bank, download it, and here you would really be able to access all the relative positions and orientations of the different pigments in such a way that you can really build up relatively accurate what would be the starting point for a theoretical description that would be having a Hamiltonian to kick off and see how far we can go. Okay? Right. So this is the abstract of an article. There's a particularly influential spectroscopy school led by Graham Fleming in Berkeley, where they move to the visible all the techniques that have been developed in multidimensional NMR. Okay? And I will discuss, let's say, as a theorist will be able to present it, what are the rudiments of the type of experiments they did. But coming back to the cartoon I showed initially, you see that they argue that we monitor this harvesting process as a function of time and frequency and show that excitation energy does not simply cascade stepwise down the energy ladder. So we try to understand what does exactly mean and what sort of experiments they've been performed, and how some argument about coherence can be deduced. So maybe, let's say, for people with a quantum optics background, I think we are not used to this type of experimental physics, right? In the sense that normally when experiments open, some experiments are performed in quantum optics, well, I think you know quite well what's going to happen. But this is experimental physics a bit in the old way, right? They do an experiment, they don't know what's going to happen, and the theory comes afterwards. which is challenging. But let's say that the first thing that you do when you don't know anything about some system, you just shake it, right? So you probe it, you do linear absorption, and if you introduce a second laser in such a way that you perform pump probe, so that you have another variable that would be the time delay between probe and pump, then you would be able to detect what would be changes in the absorption pattern that you would obtain simply by doing linear absorption experiments. Okay, this provides you already quite a bit of information, but we will see that if we perform now experiments in such a way that we have an additional field, such that I have a new time variable that will control what is the time delay in between pump number one and pump number two, then I would be able to build correlation maps where I can see what would be the relation in between excitation and detection frequencies. This will provide me with the possibility to access further aspects of the dynamics, of the transfer, of the degree of delocalization that may happen in this type of complexes. So, a sort of naive interpretation of how we should think about these experiments. Maybe, given the background of the audience, I think you should keep in mind that these are experiments where it would be possible to, in some step, create coherence, let it evolve, so that we create a phase relation between elements of a superposition, and then we have a final step where we probe coherence. Okay? So it's a, if you want, a sophistication of that idea. So, in cartoon form, if you want, what we will have is a preparation step, then a time for evolution, and then another step for mixing, and then another time variable for acquiring signal. So essentially, if we vary what is the time delay in between preparation and mixing and the time we acquire our free induction decay, then we should be able to end up with a table of this form, such that now we can, this time response, move to the frequency domain by means of performing now Fourier transformations across both axes. So the way our frequency response then will look like, well, this will give you a three-dimensional pattern that if we cross, cross at whatever height you want, will typically yield to a structure where you will have both diagonal and off-diagonal signatures. So we have then spectral features where we excite and detect at the same frequency, but there is also the possibility to excite at one frequency and then to detect at a different one. So the emergence of this type of crossfits in the spectral response is, in many occasions, a signature of being dealing with a coupled system in such a way that if we would record these correlation maps as a function of the time delay between pulses, then looking at one selected position, right, then you should be able to have, as a function of the waiting time, an oscillatory pattern that will carry on then information about all the possible frequencies in the system. and in particular would allow us to access not only the possible formation of excitons as a result of the dipolar coupling between pigments, but also excitonic beating. And these are the type of experiments that in 2007 and later caused a lot of waves in the community. Let's say that initial experiments showed oscillatory patterns in the two-dimensional response that, when performed initially at cryogenic and moving up to room temperature, did still kept showing oscillations. Probably going back to basics, if we look at the most simple experiment able to create and generate coherence, that in a quantum optics language would be a typical Ramsey setup, just think what will happen if you would prepare by means of an initial pi over 2 pulse a coherent superposition. Then during the free evolution, then we will build up, should the evolution be unitary, a phase relation between our two superposed states. We have now a second step that would be able to probe the coherence evolved in this time evolution. And then typically, as opposed to what happens entering this interferometer with an incoherent mixture of these two states, we will have a sinusoidal signal. Should we have noise in between, right? Then instead of having full contrast in our detector, we will have a damped oscillation. Okay, so effectively, these are the type of measurements that are encapsulated in this complex form of multidimensional spectroscopy. So the surprise comes that, as opposed of what would be the typical lifetime of a coherent superposition in a single pigment, which is something in the range of a few femtoseconds, now the lifetime of oscillating signals coming from excitonic superpositions are longer-lived. Okay? So the long-lived oscillations, the oscillations are long-lived as compared with what would be the typical lifetime of a ground-excited superposition in a single pigment. Possibly relevant is the fact that these oscillations persist on time scales where something interesting for biology could happen. Okay. We will not enter here. This could be possibly, should there be any interest in the topic, for a proper blackboard presentation. But the only thing I want to illustrate is that we have the theory to compute what would be the two-dimensional spectral response from a theory point of view. Okay? Even you would be able to compute it, well, program it numerically exact, having a proper time evolution, exact time evolution in between pulses. And probably, well, let's say that with some simplifications, there are even calculations with hierarchical equations of motion for the spectral response of FMO. So I think this I will jump, because otherwise we'll have no time. But let's say that the fact we can argue is that we do have experimental evidence showing long-lived, in the sense I discussed, oscillations in the spectral response from different type of natural and also artificial harvesters. So now we have two tasks to do. On the one hand, understanding from a fundamental point of view, how is that possible, right? What facilitates that indeed, in this type of complexes, and even at high temperatures, we may have coherent behavior that is still observable. And then the prospect that that would raise is that maybe, it is the case that the fact that we have coherence in those time scales may be relevant for function. Okay? Take into account that here there are two separate issues, right? On the one hand, the problem can be interesting per se, and I think everybody working in open systems will agree, right? We really want to understand how in systems that may become more and more complex, we do still keep alive quantum mechanical features. That would be one thing. But to go beyond what we'd really like to do, and where I think our input will be valuable, is in going beyond showing correlations in between the presence of coherence and, I don't know, the speed of charge separation, in the sense that to really show a quantitative relation between coherence and function, we would need something like when we show in information theory that in order to teleport with 100% efficiency, we do need to share an EBIT between Nahles and Bohr. Otherwise, that's not feasible. Okay?
So can I ask you something?
Yes.
Probably I missed some point, but so in this, if I understand correctly, so in this experiment, they show that there is some oscillations, they claim these are then due to some quantum effect, or in principle, they could also be due to classical effects.
Okay, let's say classical effects, for instance, what do you mean?
I don't know, but some classical mode.
Right. Maybe, I think the word in here, as I don't want entanglement entering into the discussion because I think it's irrelevant in this context, I think we should talk simply about coherent behavior, right? So then the precise argument would be that should you be able to make a tomography of the process, right? A tomography of the state would suffice. And write down what would be at any time the state of the system, right? Then you would have off-diagonal elements in your state. If you want to call that quantum phenomena, that's fair enough. Okay? So the argument is that if you would like to say, okay, as a result of the dipolar coupling, excitons are formed, right? If you want, that would be the first level of coherence, in the sense that this will be delocalized over a number of pigments. And then there is a second layer saying, when I do perform external probing by means of sequences of laser pulses with some definite defined separation in between them, I can access a second layer, right, that is even sensitive to having excitonic beating, right? So I excite coherent superpositions of excitonic states with a degree of delocalization, right? And then in addition, I can see a coherent phase relation in between them. Okay? Also, given the background of people in the audience, and in fact, for us, this was the initial triggering, we do know that in some situations, and specifically non-equilibrium situations, it may be advantageous to have noise in the system in such a way that coherent phenomena persist in the steady state. Right? So this for us in 2002 was, let's say, the right state of mind to say, fine, this may actually be a noise-assisted process. So, going into the historical part, yes.
So, in these experiments, since they're measuring light with which has a frequency and that's continuous, and when we talk about the state of the system, do we mean a discrete state of the seven sites or whatever, or?
Okay. Take into account that here, and this is why when we did the introduction, I mentioned that one of the things I hope this program may be useful is for suggesting new ways to interrogate these systems. Here, what you do compute is simply the nonlinear response if you want precisely the third order polarization. This is what you measure, okay? So we cannot aim in here to really provide a full reconstruction of what would be the excitonic density matrix at any t. Yeah.
So, when you
these are an interferometric, glorified interferometric.
Right. But when you say that measuring the off diagonals on this.
Right.
I'm just trying to understand what kind of state space is it? Is it a, are we thinking of just a two level system?
Okay. So, to be able to compute the two-dimensional response, right, in conditions of weak excitation, right, you can confine your analysis to the one excitation sector where each chromophore is for you a dipole, yeah, so a two-level system that in the moment that it gets excited, then you kick off the dipolar interaction and set the whole thing in motion. Okay.
Thanks for that.
Right. So what did we do? Well, the first thing we do is what I think everybody here would have done, right? That is sort of decaf the real system and to transform it into something we can easily simulate. As I said before, this complex is very well characterized, especially compared with others, in such a way that we can start off building up what would be our electronic Hamiltonian. So the first analysis I will do, I will partition the world into two. Our system is going to be the electronic degrees of freedom and everything else that may include intramolecular vibrations, everything associated with the protein. This is going to be the outside environment that I will treat initially in the simplest possible form, that is, yes, with the help of some Wimbledian master equations. So I transform the original system effectively into an interacting network where pigments are coupled via an exchange interaction. And I use the protein data bank and whatever structural information is available to build up what would be an input Hamiltonian for the description of the electronic coupling. If we only do that on modeling naively what would be the transfer to the reaction center in terms of a final dissipative process, yes, from a selected node to a sink, then we see that the transfer that would come out would be far from reaching unity in the required time scale. That would be something between 3 to 5 picoseconds. So it's clear that we, on top of this coherent Hamiltonian interaction, we need something else. We can do the first analytical calculation simply by transforming the interacting network into an homogeneous one, so I set all the polar couplings equal to j, and then one can easily see that in this type of fully connected network, in fact, the probability that you will transfer the excitation to the reaction center scales inversely proportional to the total number of pigments. So coherent interaction itself would be highly inefficient because you will tend to delocalize the excitation in some pigments that, if they are not directly connected to the reaction center, the excitation lives in limbo there. So you need something else to get it out. And what you need noise. Noise that we can model initially simply, taking into account that the time, we can separate the time scales of the excitation and the phasing phenomena. If I remember right, the lifetime of excitations in chlorophyll is something between 4 in vitro to 6 nanoseconds. So the first type of noise we will suffer is dephasing coming from whatever vibrations we have around. So if we include them phenomenologically in terms of our pure dephasing in the local basis, then you see that if we repeat the simulation for what would be the probability to transfer an initial excitation to the sink, we have that from a purely Hamiltonian evolution to include some dephasing, to include more dephasing, then we will be able to assist the transfer process and end up with a behavior like this.
Yeah, it was fast.
Yes,
to read the slide,
because I'm seeing the clock, okay. Right? Okay. So the idea, as I said, the coherent interaction will tend to delocalize the excitation among some pigments. And now, if we have some dephasing in the dynamics, what will happen is that, well, noise would be able to create now paths that were initially forbidden, right? Very much like if you have a Mach-Zehnder interferometer perfectly balanced, right? In the moment that you have dephasing, you would be able to get clicks in both detectors. So we can think of different physical mechanisms that would facilitate that dephasing, unless it becomes too strong, should be able to assist the process. And this is what we have in a representation of what would be the transfer probability as a function of environmental noise. So we encounter this typical type of non-monotonic behavior where, when noise increases, we have a reduction of destructive interference reaching a plateau for certain noise range where the transfer is almost perfect. And then, should you continue increasing the level of noise, then effectively, well, you freeze the evolution in a given pigment. So this year actually, it was 2009, there has been a nice experiment in Innsbruck with a chain of 10 ions demonstrating indeed the feasibility of noise-assisted transfer in a network. Probably unsurprising, right? But nevertheless, this experiment is not easy to do. And it's also nice to see how it's robust to degrees of static disorder. And this would be, well, definitely something that could potentially be exploited in artificial devices. But the big question is, does this have anything to do with the type of photosynthetic complexes we want to analyze? Because take into account that I've used brute force, yes?
Going back to the biological system, is there any, why did the coherence takes place and so you get this non-monotonic behavior?
We will analyze, we'll try now to go back to the...
Do you have any any way of assessing the degree of quantumness of the system? Does it remain?
What do you mean by that? What is the degree of quantumness? I answer the.
Going back to his question.
Yeah, well, the answer then is the same, right? What I mean is that the observations, right, do require that I'm not dealing with off diagonal, with purely diagonal representations, right? Take into account that here we can enter into a discussion of am I talking about the side bases, am I talking about the excitonic bases, right? Maybe it's easier to see at the level of side bases, right? So then what we claim is that should I, by some magic experiment, have access to what would be, imagine I consider as an input this Hamiltonian that I wrote, I propagate the evolution, even with this very naive time evolution just assisted by Lindblad dissipators, right? So then do I look? And the question would be, are the experiments consisting with thinking that at any time, right, the state of the system can be described by a matrix that only has diagonal entries. So the population inside 1, inside 7, inside 8, right? Let me call that incoherent or classical if you want. Well, the answer would be not. You also have off-diagonal elements, right, that are due to, well, the formation of delocalized excitons, okay? Actually, in FMO, you don't delocalize over the whole complex, includes up to 3 or 4, right?
Yes.
Okay. We can also have access what would be the spectrum of the fluctuations due to the vibrations we've put outside our system. Eh? That so far only concerns the electronic degrees of freedom. And then if you look at it, that would not be the type of spectral density that we would feel very secure formulating master equations of Lindblad form. Okay, I'll try to discuss in 10 minutes a bipronic model that provides you a unified picture in the sense that is consistent with different forms of a spectral response, exhibits an enhanced transfer efficiency, and could say that is microscopically sound. And I think the idea is relatively simple. Actually, one argument that you could have done already before would be the following back of the envelope calculation. When I show you the Ramsey setup saying that we observe long oscillations as compared with what would be the lifetime of superpositions of chromophores between the ground and the excited state. You could argue, fine, this is actually not that weird, because if I now have a coupled system, right, then if the coupling in between subsystem is such that leads to delocalized states, then if the dynamics of the coupled system is ruled by the same type of master equations that in the coupled one, which is a risky assumption, then I can build up what would be the new rates in the excitonic bases, and then indeed, excitonic superpositions will be phased slower than local ones as a result of having here a contribution that is proportional to the degree of delocalization. Okay, but we don't have any guarantee that is indeed meaningful to describe the coupled system phenomenologically with this type of artillery. So we need to benchmark the phenomena and really, in the presence of an structured environment, argue that there are microscopic mechanisms that should be able to support long-leaf coherence. Okay, so that's the aim here. Yes, to show you, and given the background many people have here on the MRG, we can go fast in the technical part, and I will just insist in the very key microscopic ingredient. So the simulations we are gonna do, and also just an illustration of how far, let's say with brute force, time-dependent density matrix renormalization group you can go. We are considering the dynamics not of the whole FMO, but actually of the lowest energy manifold. That's the one provided by the lowest energy excitons, which are the ones responsible for the strongest features in the two-dimensional plots. Okay. So then the idea is the following. I forget about reduce descriptions, and I aim at accounting for the full dynamics of electronic and vibrational degrees of freedom. Given the electronic electronic interaction, what I do is I will rewrite the whole Hamiltonian in the basis that makes diagonal the electronic coupling. So if I do that, what happens is that as a result of the electron-phonon coupling, when I look at the excitonic dynamics, then what happens is that simply as a result of rewriting, I can see that I have a term that will now try to drive population dynamics in between the excitonic states. So, in very cartoon form, imagine the form of the spectral density that will exhibit some broad background, and in addition, if I look for some excitonic splitting, I'm likely to have also some spectral feature in that frequency range. So if as a result of the external illumination, I do prepare a coherent superposition of excitonic states, as a result of the effect of the bath at frequencies far from the excitonic splitting, this will try to relax, to bring me down to the lowest excitonic state. But if I'm also coupled to selected vibrations, at the same time I have acting almost coherent driving that is trying to restore the superposition. So it's very much like having a situation in quantum optics where you are subject to a diffasive environment, but at the same time you are being coherently driven. So if we look at what would be the type of coupling strength in between electronic and vibrations, depending on the type of complexes, the phenomena I'm discussing may be more apparent or completely absent depending on the type of biomolecule, right? But we should emphasize that there are situations where you may have the same strength or comparable strengths between electronic, purely electronic, and electronic vibrational coupling, right? So if I do a simulation of these dimeric system, I can, in a numerically exact form, assess what would be the different dynamical behavior to expect in situations where I have sharp features close to excitonic gaps and where they are absent. Mm? So if we look, these are simulations where essentially a loss mid echo simulation. So we compute what would be the survival probability of excitonic superpositions. At 77 Kelvin, initially in the presence, in blue, full, and in the absence of sharp peaks in our spectral density. Mm? And we see that even at 77, this would be a possible microscopic mechanism that would allow for, in this case, even purely electronic superpositions to remain live close to the picosecond domain. One thing that I hope to make the point is that you need to provide a description that is consistent not only as far as the transfer properties are concerned, but also should be consistent with all the body of the spectroscopy that has been accumulated for decades. Mm? So we can evaluate what would be the spectral response of the model we've put forward. Mm? And what is relevant, and perhaps this is an issue that initially may not have been justified enough, our argument is that the type of coherence that is being observed is actually of mixed origin. Mm? So we are observing bibronic coherence that does require of a non-trivial dynamics in the excited state. Mm? The nice thing is that, well, theoretically, you can compute exactly what is the weight of all the different Liouville pathways contributing to the final response. And obtain results that are not in disagreement, let's say, with the type of experiments that has been reported. These ones, I believe, that are from last year. Mm? So that would argue that the model is compatible with some experimental evidence. The coherence observed is unlikely to be purely electronic, but is consistent with being of this mixed electronic vibrational origin. We don't have time, but also maybe more relevant than the harvesting process itself is the process of charge separation. In the case of plants, algae, and the cyanobacteria, charge separation is carried out always by the same complex, the photosystem II super complex. So there must be a region why that structure is really preserved across the species. Mm? So experiments by two different groups, by Van Grondele and Jennifer Ogilvie, yeah, are also consistent with having mixed vibronic coherence in the process of charge separation. Mm? But I'm afraid that I've exhausted my time, yeah? So in case you are interested, this is something we can discuss at some other time. And this is the type of viewpoint, that I think we can contribute to the understanding of why would possibly coherence be relevant. Would be trying, for instance, to think about the whole process as a thermal machine operating between high energy, sunlight, and the cold vibrational bath, and for instance, show, as we did with a simple model, that the power that you can deliver, right, has a component that depends on the coherence that can be created in the process. Should that coherence be absent, the power is lower. If it's present, it's higher, right? So this would be quantitative arguments for saying that indeed, it would be advantageous to have coherent interactions in the process. So I have to quickly jump. Yeah, and maybe to jump to the controversy, right? So there are some experiments that claim that they don't observe, or should I say, they don't observe any features that should be ascribed to coherent electronic coupling. Right? What should I say? It's difficult to judge the experiment per se, but there could be, let's say, parameters where really we would benefit of having further information, right? So let's say that should indeed the coupling electron phonon be much larger than the one we've considered, well, definitely then the contribution coming for the purely electronic part will definitely be extraordinarily short-lived. But let's say that with the type of structural information we have and the different body of experiments, including the artificial ones, I would say that there is more evidence in favor of having something that is not trivial oscillations in the electronic ground state than the opposite. So just to finish with a comment that is from the group of Greg Scholz, I think it's December 2018, let's say, in the latest experiments involving algae, they argue that what they observe does require the involvement of electronic coherence. And they claim that further investigation of the interplay between electronic coupling and nuclear degrees of freedom is in order. So I can tell you about the type of machinery we've been developing recently in order to be able to go beyond. There is a clear limit of how far you can go if you simply apply the MIG in the way I showed before. But as a final message, are quantum effects relevant for biological function? Who knows, right? But maybe the more relevant question would be that in the same way that planes don't necessarily fly exactly like those, we can have a fruitful feed of information between natural and artificial systems in order to develop a new generation of harvested or charge separation devices that do exploit coherent effects. So I just conclude showing you the Mark people are the ones in Ulm that have contributed to the several things we've talked before. And hopefully this will be our new home. I keep on saying it was winter 2019, spring, I think it's going to be summer 2019. This will be the new center for quantum bioscience in Ulm. Apologies for the delay. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Susanna, for the interesting talk. And there have been already many questions, but I'm sure that there will be more. So, yes.
Okay. So, in your 8-qubit example, where you're highly connected and then you have some reservoirs, you know, you're simulating that with what method? Is it exact diagonalization? I mean, that's what I sort of presume you use, but... Because then I think you can answer this this question about, you know, how quantum that particular simulation is. I mean, you can do the partial trace and determine the entanglement dynamics of the problem.
Sure.
I presume you must have done that at some point.
So indeed, you can do a lot of calculations, right? But what does it tell you? So imagine, indeed, I do the simulation there. In my simulation, I can perfectly access at any time what would be the state of my system, right? I can bipartition it in the way you want, compute entanglement across, and we did it, eh? But nevertheless, I don't think it carries any relevant information.
Well, it might for design of artificial devices, as you said. So if you want to maintain entanglement in a many-qubit system under the action of the environment, you know, I mean, I think that's really interesting. So that, you know, there's a lot of work in that area.
Right. Let me try to again separate the two issues, right? On the one thing is, you can focus on saying, well, I want to understand on the one hand what microscopic mechanisms may underpin coherent behavior, yeah. Problem number one, right? Now, you can then say, fine, does this have anything to do with natural complexes? Okay, there comes the issue of having to go beyond, right? Because you could have a network that would be able, as you said, of performing transfer with 100% efficiency, blah, blah, blah. If that's the only thing to do, then you can have many possible strategies to do that job. But the point is that if you want to claim any relation with natural systems, then your theory has to be able to account not only for 100% efficiency in 5 picoseconds for the transfer, you should also compile with all the spectroscopy. And that's different. That's where now different models come apart, right? And then it would be yet another issue saying, what about forgetting the natural complexes, very much like the bird? I want to build a plane and doesn't need to operate exactly like an eagle, right? And then I agree with you, yeah? Then that's a different thing, and probably, let's say, from the practical point of view, the more relevant, yeah? And let's say the guarantee of a happy end, that even if the final conclusion is that it's irrelevant for natural complexes whether or not they operate coherently, we can, and I hope we will, develop new technology that does actively exploit coherence. That absolutely.
Okay.
And I didn't discuss it, but indeed, I mean, in artificial systems, definitely, you can indeed assist your processes, right? And one of the methods we've developed recently, particularly suitable for charge separation in polymers, for instance, there we have now tools to be able to simulate really chains that are coupled to a sizable number of vibrational modes. Yeah. So indeed, I hope that these different sides of the problem have come across.
Yes. Very good.
Okay.
Okay, one more question. So in the experiments that we're claiming that you don't need long-lived coherence, are they...
In one, let's say there is one, this reminds a little bit the initial times of quantum information, right? I think there is always some groups that are strongly advocates that nothing is going to work.
So, right, yeah. So my question is, are they seeing this similar behavior and attributed to something else, or they're seeing no?
No, they are. Well, let's say that here it would be rare that you don't see oscillations because everything oscillates, right? But they indeed attribute it to different processes, right? So you can have very long-lived oscillatory signals that may come from oscillations that involve the ground electronic states and some vibrational modes in the ground state, right? This is what they claim, that they're really the responsible for the long-lived contributions do really come from the electronic ground state, right? I would say that most other experiments don't agree with that interpretation. But maybe we should also emphasize that they don't agree either with the interpretation where really everything comes just from electronic degrees of freedom. Okay? So this may have been an over-interpretation.
Okay.
I think it would be just fair to say that this is also supported by theory. I mean, it's a joint experimental theoretical paper, so it's not just experimental.
Which one you mean? The one by Miller?
Yeah, Michael.
Yeah. Right. Fine. Yeah. Right.
No, just to clarify it. It's not. They do calculations which supports what the experimenters see.
Yeah.
Isn't it correct?
Yes, they do some simulations, but I don't know what. Let's say that there are also theoretical calculations for the other experiments.
Maybe
I can also say, I mean, if you do an experiment and you do not see, let's say, for example, oscillations, or you attribute them to a specific setting, that does not mean that, and it's supported by theory, of course, for this particular experiment, doesn't mean that these effects really don't exist, because in other measurements and other experiments also were supported by theory, they are visible. It's like saying, let's say in an ion trap, I send a laser pulse on resonance on an ion, and I don't see motional side bands, and concluding there is no electron vibrational coupling. So, I mean, I think I agree that there is theory for this particular experiment, for this particular setup.
That's all I'm saying.
To be honest,
maybe a question to this. I mean, are you referring to these experiments, to these two papers that you were showing before? Are these also related? Sorry, I am not familiar with this. Are they also related to FMO complex?
It's FMO. Yeah. Should I mention that also supporting vibrational coherence? This, in addition to the reaction center ones, which I think is also nice to say that one of the group actually is not Berkeley related, right? There are also the experiments, even single molecule experiments by the group of Hank van Hulst. So, but to be honest, I would like that there would be a sort of a joint effort by the different laboratories working of FMO, a sort of proof of principle where Richard Kochtel gives a sample, right, to everybody, and then at least it's concluded, okay, this type of molecular systems is able to support coherence. That would be nice, yeah.
Also, because again, another related question from a non-expert. I mean, it seems to me that Martin was mentioning the Kardashian type of experiments, that these type of experiments are under much less strict, you know, experimental conditions compared to the quantum optical systems we work with. Or am I wrong? I mean, when we are used to quantum optics, we are used to something that we are able to model very well, precisely, and control very well. Yeah. It seems to me that probably it is much more difficult in these experimental scenarios actually to reach the level of precision that we are used to when we deal with.
This is one of the problems in this. I mean, I would say. When I give a talk, I sometimes explain this by saying, in quantum information, if I suggest an experiment, I can put my money on this. I can say in 5 years this will be done because I know everything about the system. In these systems, in biological systems, even the fundamental premises are not necessarily clear. So I make a theory, and then the experiment really has to confirm not so much the calculation, but actually the underlying assumptions behind that.
And also from the theory viewpoint, I mean, the amount of information that is contained in the two-dimensional response, I think is something that we should scrutinize forward. Yeah. Final comment. And also to clarify the conclusions that one can get and the nature of the coherence, it would also be nice to incorporate control techniques, right, in such a way that, for instance, we try to minimize what is the signal that is coming from these boring ground state oscillations, filter them out, and then hopefully see in full glory the excited state manifold beating.
Yes, first one question. Please do, because I've been neglecting you. I know that you're listening, and then Martin again.
No, just, I mean, the basic mechanism that is behind this dissipation terms, can I think of it that it acts like projecting out by a Zeno effect parts of the Hilbert space and leaving a Hilbert space in which transport is pretty efficient, and more efficient than in the full Hilbert space that would be available if you had no defacing at all, or what is the kind of picture?
Okay, if you want to see, yes, what would be the way where the transfer efficiency can be enhanced by defacing, right? Well, you
so,
can...
So is it because you're leaving some subspace untouched in which the transport is very fast?
Okay, that is...
Picture?
Right. Let's say that if you are thinking about the situation I showed with the many ring-like complexes, right? There you can have a picture a little bit in the direction you are thinking, right? With the formation of some dark states that would actually be able to propagate. So I will bring a post down to the conference where indeed something like that happened.
Okay, but yeah? It's not the generic thing, you're saying. So just to have a picture of how this transport.
The point is that it depends, right? You see that for this type of antenna complexes, this would be relevant, while not necessarily in the case of FMO. That's why I try to divide it, let's say, into cases where you simply have one complex doing the job of the transfer, and in more complicated situations where you do have an array where then different timescales that involve delocalization and diffusion are very separate, right? And there, this will be a situation where you have the interplay of coherent delocalization combined with thermal hopping in between rings. Yeah.
Just to add to that, I think that for me the simplest way to think about it is a resonance thing, right?
Yeah,
these two
but
level systems are out of resonance, but if you have fluctuations. That helps to sort of get things
right. This is entirely classical.
Resonance. And
the other is that, let's say, paths that were forbidden when the coupling is purely coherent are now open up, like in the Mach-Zehnder I mentioned before. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I want to maybe say one thing to. It's the observation of the ground state. So let's say to attributing these oscillations in the observed oscillations to purely ground state vibrational effects, which is can be fine in many in some cases it might be, but one should maybe not forget that even that can only happen if there's coupling between the electronic and the vibrational degrees of freedom.
I don't know, but this is a different thing, because I think this is called the Jonas-like mechanism, yeah? No, but I think Miller disagrees with that, yeah? No, he excludes the possibility that maybe electronically assisted, right? This is Donata, for instance, the one that...
I think the
interpretation of Miller is that it's really... ground state coherence full stop.
Exactly, but even to set this in motion, one needs electronic vibrational coupling at some point.
Yeah.
And it's the first two laser pulses that set this in motion.
I would say it's inescapable to have some contribution from the electronic
state. What I want to say is, even though they claim that it's pure, it's boring, so to speak, what they see, it's actually still interesting. Because it still reveals a term in the Hamiltonian that is there, and that that can, under other circumstances, actually create excited state coherences.
So, unless there are other urgent questions, probably we can conclude. This has been a very lively discussion, as we expected. But of course, both Susanna and Martin are here for the program, so I invite everyone to go and talk with them. And Lincoln has to say something before I say.
Well, it's just a thought for a discussion that could be interesting. You know, what could we learn from these studies in terms of design of quantum simulators and ways that we could operate quantum simulators to investigate, you know, the airplane versus the eagle, so to speak. And I think that there's probably a very good dialogue possible, and that could be a good discussion topic, because it's rather the point of the program.
Good topic for the Friday.
Just a thought.
Yeah. Yes.
And maybe also what sort of experiments we could think of that maybe would be able to keep this complexity of the two-dimensional response. Is there something else we can think of?
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.